thing. You can't imagine what we'll do to you. Usha shouted back insults, and Aku Yadav replied with vivid descriptions of how he would rape her, burn her with acid, slaughter her. He and his men tried to batter the door down, so Usha turned on the cylinder of gas the family used for cooking and grabbed a match. If you break into the house, I'll light the match and blow us all up, she shouted wildly. The thugs could smell the gas, and they hesitated. Back off or you'll get blown up, Usha shouted again. The attackers stepped back. Meanwhile, word of the confrontation had rushed around the neighborhood. The Dalits were deeply proud of Usha's schooling and success, and the thought that Aku Yadav could destroy her was agonizing. The neighbors gathered at a distance, not knowing quite what to do. But when they saw Usha fighting back and hurling abuse at Aku Yadav, finally forcing his gang to retreat, they found courage. Soon there were 100 angry Dalits on the street, and they began picking up sticks and stones. People realized that if he could do this to Usha, there was just no hope, one neighbor explained. Stones began to fly toward Aku Yadav's men, who saw the crowd's ugly mood and fled. The mood in the slum became giddy. For the first time, the people had won a confrontation. The Dalits marched through the slum, celebrating. Then they went down the street to Aku Yadav's house and burned it to the ground. Aku Yadav went to the police, who arrested him for his own protection. Apparently, the police officers planned to keep him in custody until the mood cooled and then to let him go. A bail hearing for Aku Yadav was scheduled, and rumors spread that the police were planning to release him as part of a corrupt bargain. The bail hearing was to take place miles away in the center of Nagpur. Hundreds of women marched there from Kasturba Nagar and filed into the high-ceilinged grand courtroom with its marble floor and faded British grandeur. The Dalit women were uneasy there in their sandals and faded saris, but they took seats near the front. Aku Yadav strutted in, confident and unrepentant, sensing that the women were disoriented in the grand setting of the courtroom. Spotting one woman he had raped, he mocked her as a prostitute and shouted that he would rape her again. She rushed forward and hit him on the head with a slipper. This time, either I will kill you or you will kill me, she shrieked. At that, the dam burst, apparently by prearrangement. All the women from Kasturba Nagar pressed forward and surrounded Aku Yadav, screaming and shouting. Some pulled chili powder from under their clothes and threw it in the faces of Aku Yadav and the two police officers guarding him. The police, blinded and overwhelmed, fled at once. Then the women pulled out knives from their clothing and began stabbing Aku Yadav. "Forgive me," he shouted in terror now. "Forgive me, I won't do it again." The women passed their knives around and kept stabbing him. Each woman had agreed to stab him at least once. Then, in a macabre retaliation for his having cut off Asho Bhagat's breasts, the women hacked off Aku Yadav's penis. By the end, he was mincemeat. When we visited, the courtroom walls were still stained with his blood. The bloodied women marched triumphantly back to Kasturba Nagar to tell their husbands and fathers that they had destroyed the monster. The slum erupted in celebration. Families put on music and danced in the streets. They dug into their savings to buy lamb and sweets, and they handed out fruit to their friends. Throughout Kasturba Nagar, the festivities resembled a giant wedding. It was clear that the attack on Aku Yadav had been carefully planned, and Usha was the obvious leader. So even though Usha could conveniently prove that she was not in the courtroom that day, the police arrested her. However, the killing had focused public attention on the plight of Kasturba Nagar, and there was an outcry. A retired high court judge, Bau Vahane, publicly sided with the women, saying, "In the circumstances they underwent, they were left with no alternative but to finish Aku." The women repeatedly pleaded with the police for their security, but the police failed to protect them. Then the hundreds of women in the slum decided among themselves that if they all claimed responsibility, no one person would be culpable for the murder. They reasoned that if several hundred women each had stabbed Eku Yadov once, then no single stab wound could have been the fatal one. Across Kasturba Nagar, there was a single refrain among the women. "We all killed him. Arrest us all." "We all take responsibility for what happened," said Rajashri Rangdal, a shy young mother. Jija Moore, a prim housewife of 45, added, "I'm proud of what we did. If anybody has to be punished, we'll all be punished." With considerable satisfaction, Jija asserted, "We women have become fearless. We were protecting the men." The police, grim and frustrated, released Usha after 2 weeks, but only on the condition that she stay in the area. Her career as a hotel manager is probably over, and she is sure that members of Eku Yadov's gang will seek revenge by raping her or throwing acid on her face. "I don't care about that," she says dismissively, with a confident toss of her head. "I'm not worried about them." She began a new life as a community organizer, using her management skills to bring the Dalits together to make pickles, clothing, and other products to sell in the markets. She wants the Dalits to start businesses to raise their incomes so that they can afford more education. Now Usha is struggling to make ends meet, but she is the galvanic new boss of Kasturba Nagar, the heroine of the slum. When we went to visit her, our taxi driver had trouble finding her home. He stopped periodically in Kasturba Nagar to ask for directions, but each person the driver asked insisted that there was no such person, or else directed the vehicle away from the neighborhood. Finally, we called Usha to report our difficulties, and she came out onto the main street to flag us down and show us the way, explaining that each of the people who had misdirected us had sent a child running over to her, warning her that a stranger was looking for her. "They're trying to protect me," Usha explained, laughing. "The whole community is looking out for me." The saga of Kasturba Nagar is unsettling, with no easy moral. After years of watching women quietly accept abuse, it is cathartic to see someone like Usha lead a countercharge, even if we're uncomfortable with the bloody denouement and cannot condone murder. Empowerment is a cliché in the aid community, but it is truly what is needed. The first step toward greater justice is to transform that culture of female docility and subservience so that women themselves become more assertive and demanding. As we said earlier, that is, of course, easy for outsiders like us to say. We're not the ones who run horrible risks for speaking up. But when a woman does stand up, it's imperative that outsiders champion her. We also must nurture institutions to protect such people. Sometimes we may even need to provide asylum for those whose lives are in danger. More broadly, the single most important way to encourage women and girls to stand up for their rights is education. And we can do far more to promote universal education in poor countries. Ultimately, women like those in Kasturba Nagar need to join the human rights revolution themselves. They constitute part of the answer to the problem. There will be less trafficking and less rape if more women stop turning the other cheek and begin slapping back. The New Abolitionists. Zach Hunter was 12 years old and living with his family in Atlanta when he heard in school that forms of slavery still exist in the world today. He was flabbergasted and began reading up on the subject. The more he read, the more horrified he was, and although he was only a seventh grader, he thought he could raise money to fight forced labor. So he formed a group called Loose Change to Loosen Chains, nicknamed LC2LC, a student-run campaign against modern slavery. In his first year, he raised $8,500. Since then, his campaign has ballooned. Zach, now in high school, travels around the country constantly, speaking to schools and church groups about human trafficking. His MySpace page describes his occupation as abolitionist/student, and his hero is William Wilberforce. In 2007, Zach presented to the White House a petition with 100,000 signatures, seeking more action on trafficking. He also published a book for teenagers, Be the Change, Your Guide to Ending Slavery and Changing the World. And he is nurturing other LC2LC chapters in schools and churches across the country. Zach is part of an exploding movement of social entrepreneurs who offer new approaches to supporting women in the developing world. Aid workers function in the context of an aid bureaucracy, while social entrepreneurs create their own context by starting a new organization, company, or movement to address a social problem in a creative way. Social entrepreneurs tend not to have the traditional liberal suspicion of capitalism, and many charge for services and use a business model to achieve sustainability. Social entrepreneurs are not content just to give a fish or to teach how to fish, says Bill Drayton, a former management consultant and government official who popularized the idea of social entrepreneurship. They will not rest until they have revolutionized the fishing industry. Drayton is the founder of Ashoka, an organization that supports and trains social entrepreneurs around the world. They are called Ashoka Fellows, and there are now more than 2,000 of them, many involved in women's rights campaigns. Drayton's brief history of the rise of social entrepreneurs goes like this. The agricultural revolution produced only a small surplus, so only a small elite could move into the towns to create culture and conscious history. This pattern persisted ever since. Only a few have held the monopoly on initiative because they alone have had the social tools. That is one reason that per capita income in the West remained flat from the fall of the Roman Empire until about 1700. By 1700, however, a new, more open architecture was beginning to develop in Northern Europe, entrepreneurial/competitive business facilitated by more tolerant, open politics. One result? The West broke out from 1,200 years of stagnation and soon soared past anything the world had seen before. Average per capita income rose 20% in the 1700s, 200% in the 1800s, and 740% in the last century. However, until about 1980, this transformation bypassed the social half of the world's operations. It was only about 1980 that the ice began to crack, and the social arena as a whole made the structural leap to this new entrepreneurial competitive architecture. However, once the ice broke, catch-up change came in a rush, and it did so pretty much all across the world, the chief exceptions being areas where governments were afraid. Because it has the advantage of not having to be the pioneer, but rather of following business, this second great transformation has been able steadily to compound productivity growth at a very fast rate. In this respect, it resembles successful developing countries like Thailand. Ashoka's best estimate is that the citizen sector is halving the gap between its productivity level and that of business every 10 to 12 years. Think how much more effective a women's rights movement could be if backed by an army of social entrepreneurs. The United Nations and the aid bureaucracies have undertaken a relentless search for technical solutions, including improved vaccines and new processes for boring wells, and those are important. But progress also depends on political and cultural remedies, and, frankly, on charisma. Often the key is a person with a knack for leadership. Martin Luther King Jr. in the United States, Mahatma Gandhi in India, and William Wilberforce in Britain. It's important to invest in these emerging leaders as well as in processes, and aid organizations have largely missed the boat that Drayton launched with Ashoka. It does seem to be a major blind spot in development and government efforts, notes David Bornstein, who wrote an excellent book about social entrepreneurs called How to Change the World. The big donors, whether government aid groups or large philanthropic organizations, want to make systematic interventions that are scalable, and there are good reasons for that. But as a result, they miss opportunities to bring about social change by failing to set up networks to identify and support individual leaders who can make a difference in the trenches. Donors typically aren't set up to make small, targeted grants at the community level, but such grants can become an important tool to achieve change. A few groups have operated as venture capital providers to support small-scale programs abroad, and in fact, that is precisely what Ashoka does with its support of Ashoka Fellows. Likewise, the International Fund for Women, run by a former graduate school classmate of Cheryl's, Kavita Ramdas, since 1987, has supported more than 3,800 women's organizations in 167 countries. The International Women's Health Coalition, based in New York, is best known for advocacy, but it also supports small organizations around the globe that support women. Zach is a brilliant social entrepreneur. So are Ruchira Gupta and Usha Narayan. While women worldwide have generally not risen far in the ranks of political leaders, they often dominate the ranks of social entrepreneurs. Even in countries where men monopolize political power, women have formed their own influential organizations and have enjoyed considerable success in bringing about change. In particular, many women have risen as social entrepreneurs to provide leadership in the new abolitionist movement against sex traffickers. One of these is Sunitha Krishnan, an Ashoka Fellow from India who is legendary among those fighting trafficking. We had heard so much about her that when we finally met, it was a surprise to see how tiny she is, and her diminutive stature, at 4.5 feet tall, is accentuated by a congenital cleft foot that causes her to limp. When Sunitha was a middle-class child in kindergarten, she took a slate and went to teach a group of poor children what she had learned in school that day. She was so moved by that experience that she decided to become a social worker. She studied social work in college and graduate school in India. Her focus was on literacy. Then, one day, she was with a group of fellow students trying to organize poor people in a village, and a gang of men resented the interference. "They didn't like it, and they decided to teach us a lesson," Sunitha recalls. She was telling us her story in her small, bare office in the shelter she runs in the city of Hyderabad, nearly 1,000 miles southwest of the village in Bihar where Ruchira Gupta is fighting to keep Meena alive. Sunitha speaks in polished, upper-class Indian English, sounding more like a university professor than an activist. She is detached and analytical, but still quietly furious when she explains what happened next. The gang of men opposed to her efforts raped her. Sunitha didn't go to the police. "I recognized the futility of it," she says. But Sunitha found herself blamed and her family stigmatized. "The rape per se didn't impact me so much," she says. "What affected me more was the way society treated me, the way people looked at me. Nobody questioned why those guys did it. They questioned why I went there, why my parents gave me freedom. And I realized that what happened to me was a one-time thing, but for many people, it was a daily thing." That was when Sunitha decided to switch her career focus from literacy to sex trafficking. She traveled around the country talking to as many prostitutes as possible, trying to understand the world of commercial sex. She settled in Hyderabad, shortly before the police launched a crackdown there on one red light district. Perhaps the brothel owners hadn't paid enough bribes and needed a nudge. The crackdown was a catastrophe. Overnight, the brothels in that area were closed, with no provision for the girls working there. The prostitutes were so stigmatized that there was no place they could go and no way for them to earn money. "Many of the women started committing suicide," Sunitha remembers. "I was helping cremate dead bodies. Death was binding people together. I went back to the women and said, 'Tell me exactly what you want us to do.' And they said, 'Don't do anything for us. Do something for our children.'" Sunitha worked closely with a Catholic missionary, Brother Joe Vatikatil. He has died, but a picture of him hangs in her office, and his faith left a powerful impression on her. "I'm a staunch Hindu," she says, though the way of Christ inspires me. Sunitha and Brother Joe started a school in a former brothel. At first, out of 5,000 children of prostitutes who were eligible to attend, just 5 enrolled. But the school grew, and soon Sunitha started shelters as well, for the children and also for girls and women who were rescued from the brothels. She called her organization Prajwala, which means an eternal flame. www.prajwalaindia.org. Although one red light district had been closed, there were others in Hyderabad, and Sunitha began to organize rescues from those brothels. She prowled the foulest, most sordid neighborhoods of the city, fearlessly talking to prostitutes and trying to galvanize them to work together and inform on the pimps. She confronted pimps and brothel owners and gathered evidence that she took to the police, browbeating them to mount raids. All this infuriated the brothel owners, who couldn't understand why a sparrow-sized woman, a girl, was standing up to them and making business so unprofitable. The brothel owners organized and began to fight back. Thugs attacked Sunitha and those working with her. She says her right eardrum was ruptured, leaving her deaf in that ear, and one arm was broken. Sunitha's first employee was Akbar, a former pimp who had developed a conscience. He worked valiantly to help girls who were imprisoned in the red light district. But the brothel owners retaliated by stabbing Akbar to death. When Sunitha had to tell his family that he had been killed, she realized that she had to be more cautious. "We realized over time that it was not sustainable," she says of her early approach. "I realized that if I'm going to be here for a long time, I have to be accountable to my team, to their families. I can't expect everyone to be a mad person like me." Prajwala increasingly began to work with the government and aid groups to provide rehabilitation, counseling, and other services. Sunitha trained the former prostitutes not only to make crafts or bind books, the kind of thing that other rescue organizations do, but also to be welders or carpenters. So far, Prajwala has rehabilitated some 1,500 young women by moving them through 6 to 8 months of job training that will help them start new careers. The rehabilitation centers are a curious sight in India. They are alive with the sounds of hammering and shouts, with young women pounding nails, lugging steel bars, and operating machinery. Prajwala also helps some women return to their families, or get married, or live on their own. So far, Sunitha says, 85% of the women have been able to stay out of prostitution, while 15% have returned. Sunitha herself plays down the success. "There's more prostitution now than when we started," Sunitha confided grimly at one point. "I'd say we failed. We rescue 10 people and 20 come into the brothels." But that is far too bleak an evaluation. One warm and sunny day in Hyderabad, Sunitha's brisk efficiency evaporates as she leaves her office. The stern ferocity that she displays toward government officials melts and is replaced by a tenderness as children at her school gather round, laughing and shouting. She greets them by name and asks them about their schoolwork. A simple lunch of dal and chapati is served on battered tin plates to everyone in the compound. While nibbling on her chapati, Sunitha catches up with one of her volunteers, Abbas Bey, a young woman with black hair, light chocolate skin, and white teeth. Abbas had been taken to Delhi as a young teenager to work as a maid, but instead she found herself sold to a brothel and beaten with a cricket bat to induce obedience. 3 days later, Abbas and all 70 girls in the brothel were made to gather round and watch as the pimps made an example of another teenage girl who had fought customers and tried to lead the other girls into a rebellion. The troublesome girl was stripped naked, hog-tied, humiliated and mocked, beaten savagely, and then stabbed in the stomach until she bled to death in front of Abbas and the others. After Abbas was eventually freed in a brothel raid, Sunitha encouraged her to come to Prajwala to learn a vocational skill. Today, Abbas is learning to be a bookbinder and also counsels other girls about how to avoid being trafficked. Sunitha arranged for Abbas to be tested for HIV. She tested positive, so Sunitha is trying to find her an HIV-positive man to marry. Sunitha and Abbas both want all brothels closed down, not just regulated, and Sunitha's voice carries growing weight in the region. A dozen years ago, it would have been absurd to think that a young female social worker, small in stature and with a club foot, could have any impact on the mobs that run the brothels in Hyderabad. Aid groups were too sensible to tackle the problem. Yet Sunitha brazenly marched into the red light districts and started her own organization, in a way emblematic of social entrepreneurs. They can be difficult, seemingly unreasonable people. But these very qualities are sometimes precisely what allows them to succeed. On her own, Sunitha would have lacked the resources to wage her campaigns against the brothels, but American donors have supported her and multiplied her impact. Catholic Relief Services, in particular, has been a stalwart supporter of Sunitha and the Prajwala programs. The networks and introductions that Bill Drayton made for her, as an Ashoka Fellow, also magnified her voice. It's a prototype of the kind of alliance between First World and Third that the abolitionist movement needs. Chapter 4. Rule by Misogyny. The mechanism of violence is what destroys women, controls women, diminishes women, and keeps women in their so-called place. Eve Ensler, A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer. Rape has become endemic in South Africa, so a medical technician named Sonet Ehlers developed a product that immediately grabbed national attention there. Ehlers had never forgotten a rape victim telling her forlornly, "If only I had teeth down there." Sometime afterward, a man came into the hospital where Ehlers works in excruciating pain because his penis was stuck in his pant zipper. Ehlers merged those images and came up with a product she called Rape-X. It resembles a tube with barbs inside. The woman inserts it like a tampon with an applicator, and any man who tries to rape the woman impales himself on the barbs and must go to an emergency room to have the Rape-X removed. When critics complained that it was a medieval punishment, Ehlers responded tersely, "A medieval device for a medieval deed." The Rape-X is a reflection of the gender-based violence that is ubiquitous in much of the developing world, inflicting far more casualties than any war. Surveys suggest that about 1/3 of all women worldwide face beatings in the home. Women aged 15 through 44 are more likely to be maimed or die from male violence than from cancer, malaria, traffic accidents, and war combined. A major study by the World Health Organization found that in most countries, between 30% and 60% of women had experienced physical or sexual violence by a husband or boyfriend. Violence against women by an intimate partner is a major contributor to the ill health of women, said the former general director of WHO, Lee Jong-wook. Rape is so stigmatizing that many women do not report it, and thus researchers have difficulty tabulating accurate figures. Yet some evidence suggests that it is very widespread. 21% of Ghanaian women reported in one survey that their sexual initiation was by rape. 17% of Nigerian women said that they had endured rape or attempted rape by the age of 19. And 21% of South African women reported that they had been raped by the age of 15. Violence against women is also constantly mutating into new forms. The first documented acid attack occurred in 1967 in what is now Bangladesh. Now it is increasingly common for men in South Asia or Southeast Asia to take sulfuric acid and hurl it in the faces of girls or women who have spurned them. The acid melts the skin and sometimes the bones underneath. If it strikes the eyes, the woman is blinded. In the world of misogyny, that is technological innovation. Such violence often functions to keep women down. One impediment for women planning to run for political office in Kenya is the cost of round-the-clock security. That protection is needed to prevent political enemies from having them raped, Gangsters calculate that female candidates can be uniquely humiliated and discredited that way. The result is that Kenyan women candidates routinely carry knives and wear multiple sets of tights to deter, complicate, and delay any attempted rape. In many poor countries, the problem is not so much individual thugs and rapists, but an entire culture of sexual predation. That's the world of Wainashet Zebene. Wainashet, a light-skinned black girl in Ethiopia, keeps her long hair brushed back, letting it frame a face that is almost always serious, determined, studious. She grew up in a rural area where kidnapping and raping girls is a time-honored tradition. In the Ethiopian countryside, if a young man has an eye on a girl but doesn't have a bride price, the equivalent of a dowry but paid by the man, or if he doubts that the girl's family will accept him, then he and several friends kidnap the girl and he rapes her. That immediately improves his bargaining position because she is ruined and will have difficulty marrying anyone else. The risks to the boy are minimal, since the girl's parents never prosecute the rapist. That would aggravate the harm to their daughter's reputation and would be resented in the community as a breach of tradition. Indeed, at the time of Wainashet's rape, Ethiopian law explicitly provided that a man could not be prosecuted for violating a woman or girl he later married. "There were many cases like this in our village," said Wainashet's father, Zebene, who left years ago to work as a peddler in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, returning regularly to visit his family. "I knew it was very bad for the girl, but there was nothing to do. They all married the man. When he goes free, people see that, and they do it again and again." Wainashet and her father were sitting in his shack trying to explain what had happened. The shack is on the edge of Addis Ababa, and the traffic noise from beeping cars and buses without mufflers provided a steady background clamor. Neighbors were on all sides, separated by thin walls, and Wainashet and her father spoke in low voices so no one would hear of the girl's rape. Wainashet was reserved, looking at her hands and occasionally at her father as he attempted to explain that the villagers are not bad people. "Stealing is a very shameful act in the villages," he said. "If someone steals a goat, the people would beat him up." "But kidnapping a girl is okay." "More weight is still given to the crime of stealing a thing than to the crime of stealing a person," Zebene said sadly. He looked over at Wainashet and added, "I never thought this would happen to my family." Then Wainashet took over the story, continuing to look mostly downward. She sat in the dim hut and with quiet dignity told what had happened when she was still living in the village as a 13-year-old seventh grader. "We were deep asleep when they came," she said calmly. "Maybe it was 11:30 at night. I think there were more than four of them. There was no electricity, but they had a flashlight with them. They broke down the door and took me. We were shouting, but nobody heard us. Or at least, nobody came." Wainashet didn't know her kidnapper, Aberu Jema, and had never spoken to him. But Aberu had noticed her. For 2 days, the kidnappers casually battered and raped Wainashet. Her family and a teacher went to the police and demanded that they rescue her. As the police approached, Wainashet escaped, hurtling down the village path, screaming, covered in blood and bruises. Zebene returned to the village from the capital as soon as he heard of his daughter's kidnapping, and he was not inclined to have his loving, studious daughter marry the man who had raped her. In Addis Ababa, he had often heard radio commercials about women's rights aired by the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association. He had seen women in the capital working confidently, holding meaningful jobs, enjoying rights and a measure of equality. So Zebene talked to Wainashet, and they decided that she would refuse to marry Aberu. Both Zebene and Wainashet are quiet and unassuming, but possess steel spines. Both are disinclined to back down. They were appalled by what had happened and refused to be mollified as tradition demanded. They decided that Wainashet would report the rape as a crime. She walked 5 miles to the nearest bus stop, waited 2 days for a bus, then endured the grueling journey to a town with a health center. There, she underwent a pelvic exam by a nurse who wrote in her health record, "She is no longer a virgin. Many bruises and scratches." When Wainachet returned to the village, the elders encouraged her family to settle the dispute with Abeiru. Seeking to avoid a blood feud, they repeatedly pressured Zebene to accept a couple of cows for allowing Wainachet to marry Abeiru. Zebene refused to even discuss such a transaction. As the stalemate persisted, Abeiru and his family became increasingly concerned that they might be prosecuted, so they devised a solution. Abeiru kidnapped Wainachet again, took her far away, and then resumed the beatings and rapes, demanding that she consent to marriage. Wainachet managed to escape, but she was recaptured during what was, for her, a 3-day hike back home. Remarkably, Abeiru even took her to the local court after kidnapping her so that she could be bullied into telling court officials that she wanted to marry him. Instead, Wainachet, a battered, pint-sized girl surrounded by men who were threatening her, told the court official that she had been abducted and she pleaded to be allowed to go home. The official, a man, didn't want to listen to a girl and told Wainachet to get it over with and marry Abeiru. "Even if you go home, Abeiru will go after you again," the official told her. "So there's no point in resisting." Wainachet was determined not to marry anyone yet, let alone her kidnapper. "I wanted to stay in school," she recalled, speaking softly but with utter determination. Abeiru was keeping her inside a house in a walled compound, but one time she was able to scale the wall and flee. Everyone saw her and heard her scream, yet no one helped. "People were saying I broke tradition," Wainachet said bitterly, and she looked up for a moment from her hands. "They were criticizing me, saying I had escaped. I was furious with that attitude." In the hope of staying alive, Wainachet moved to the police station and was housed in a jail cell, so the rape victim was in a cell and the rapist was free. The police belatedly gathered evidence, including the broken door to Wainachet's home and her torn and bloody clothing. They also collected statements from witnesses, who included a great many people in the village. But the judges to whom the case was presented thought that prosecution of Abeiru was a mistake. At a court hearing, the judge told Wainachet, "He wants to marry you. Why are you refusing?" Finally, the judge sentenced Abeiru to 10 years in prison. But a month later, for reasons that are unclear, the judge released him. Wainachet fled to Addis Ababa, where she moved into her father's shack and resumed her studies. "I decided to leave and go someplace where no one would recognize me," she said. Then she added slowly and firmly, "I will never marry anyone. I don't want to deal with any man." Such a culture in rural Ethiopia might seem impervious to change, but Wainachet found support in an unlikely corner. Indignant Americans, mostly women, who wrote angry letters demanding change in the Ethiopian legal code. They couldn't undo the trauma Wainachet suffered, but the moral support was important to her and her father. Reassurance when virtually everyone around them condemned the family for breaching tradition. Americans also provided financial support and a stipend to help Wainachet pursue her education in Addis Ababa. The letter writers were mobilized by Equality Now, an advocacy organization based in New York that tackles abuses of women around the world. Its founder, Jessica Newworth, had worked at Amnesty International and had seen how letter-writing campaigns could help free political prisoners. So, in 1992, she founded Equality Now. It has been an uphill struggle to get enough donations to sustain the effort, but Jessica has kept Equality Now going with the support of guardian angels, including Gloria Steinem and Meryl Streep. Today, it has a staff of 15 in New York, London, and Nairobi, with an annual budget of $2 million, pocket change in the world of philanthropy. Equality Now launched appeals on behalf of Wainachet, but it seems unlikely that Abeiru will go to prison again. However, Equality Now's army of letter writers did shine enough of a spotlight on Ethiopia that it was shamed into changing its laws. Today, a man is liable for rape even if the victim later agrees to marry him. Of course, that's only the law, and in poor countries, laws rarely matter much outside the capital. We sometimes think that Westerners invest too much effort in changing unjust laws and not enough in changing culture by building schools or assisting grassroots movements. Even in the United States, after all, what brought equal rights to blacks wasn't the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments passed after the Civil War, but rather the grassroots civil rights movement nearly 100 years later. Laws matter, but typically, changing the law by itself accomplishes little. Madaher Paulos, the dynamic woman who runs the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association, agrees. The association does much of its work by filing suits or otherwise lobbying to change laws, but Madaher acknowledges that change has to be felt in the culture as well as the legal code. Empowering women begins with education, she said. She sees the cadre of educated women growing. Some 12,000 women a year now volunteer with the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association, giving it political as well as legal weight. Equality Now works closely with the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association, and that is a useful model. We, in the West, can best help by playing supporting roles to local people. And the Ethiopian Women Lawyers Association may soon have another volunteer. Wainashet is now in high school, getting good grades and planning to go to university and study law. I would like, God willing, to take on cases of abduction, she said simply. If I can't get justice for myself, I'll get justice for others. Behind the rapes and other abuse heaped on women in much of the world, it's hard not to see something more sinister than just libido and prurient opportunism, namely, sexism and misogyny. How else to explain why so many more witches were burned than wizards? Why is acid thrown in women's faces but not in men's? Why are women so much more likely to be stripped naked and sexually humiliated than men? Why is it that in many cultures, old men are respected as patriarchs, while old women are taken outside the village to die of thirst or to be eaten by wild animals? Granted, in the societies where these abuses take place, men also suffer more violence than males do in America. But the brutality inflicted on women is particularly widespread, cruel, and lethal. These attitudes are embedded in culture and will change only with education and local leadership. But outsiders have their supporting role to play too, in part by shining a spotlight on these regressive attitudes in an effort to break the taboo that often surrounds them. In 2007, Senators Joseph Biden and Richard Lugar first introduced the International Violence Against Women Act, which will be reintroduced annually until it becomes law. The bill provides for $175 million a year in foreign aid to try to prevent honor killings, bride burnings, genital cutting, acid attacks, mass rapes, and domestic violence. The bill would also create an Office of Women's Global Initiatives in the immediate office of the Secretary of State, and a Women's Global Development Office in the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. Both offices would press to make gender-based violence a diplomatic priority. For all our skepticism about laws, this one, like the landmark 2000 legislation that required annual reports about human trafficking abroad, would have a real, if incremental, impact around the world. It won't solve any problem completely, but it could make a difference to girls like Wainashet. In talking about misogyny and gender-based violence, it would be easy to slip into the conceit that men are the villains, but it's not true. Granted, men are often brutal to women, yet it is women who routinely manage brothels in poor countries, who ensure that their daughters' genitals are cut, who feed sons before daughters, who take their sons but not their daughters to clinics for vaccination. One study suggests that women perpetrators were involved, along with men, in one quarter of the gang rapes in the Sierra Leone Civil War. Typically, women fighters would lure a victim to the rape site, and then restrain her as she was raped by male fighters. We would help capture her and hold her down, one woman ex-combatant explained. The author of the study, Dara K. Cohen, cites evidence from Haiti, Iraq, and Rwanda to suggest that female participation in Sierra Leone's sexual violence was not an anomaly. She argues that ubiquitous gang rape in civil wars isn't about sexual gratification, but rather is a way for military units, including their female members, to bond by engaging in sometimes brutally misogynistic violence. Female infanticide persists in many countries, and often it is mothers who kill their own daughters. Dr. Michael H. Stone, a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and expert on infanticide, obtained data on Pakistani women who killed their daughters. He found that they usually did so because their husbands threatened to divorce them if they kept the girl. For example, a woman named Shahnaz poisoned her daughter to avoid being divorced by her husband. Praveen poisoned her daughter after her father-in-law beat her for giving birth to a girl. Yet sometimes women in Pakistan or China kill their newborn daughters simply because daughters are less prestigious than sons. Rehana drowned her daughter because girls are unlucky. As for wife beating, one survey found support for it from 62% of Indian village women themselves, and no group systematically abuses young women more cruelly than mother-in-laws, who serve as household matriarchs in much of the world and take charge of disciplining the younger women. The experience of Zoya Najabi, a 21-year-old woman from a middle-class family in Kabul, Afghanistan, illustrates the point. She came to our interview wearing blue jeans with embroidered flowers and looked more like an American than an Afghan. She went to school up to the 8th grade, but then, after her marriage at age 12 to a 16-year-old boy, she was subjected to constant corporal punishment. Not only my husband, but his brother, his mother, and his sister, they all beat me, Zoya recalled indignantly, speaking at a shelter in Kabul. Even worse, they would punish her for faulty housework by tying her to a bucket and dunking her in the well, leaving her freezing, gasping, and half-drowned. The worst moment came when Zoya's mother-in-law was beating her, and Zoya unthinkingly kicked back. Resisting a mother-in-law is an outrageous sin. First, Zoya's husband dug out an electrical cable and flogged his wife until she fell unconscious. Then, the next day, her father-in-law strapped Zoya's feet together, tied her down, and gave a stick to the mother-in-law, who whipped the soles of Zoya's feet. "My feet were beaten until they were like yogurt," Zoya said. "All my days there were unhappy, but that was the worst." "Mostly those kinds of beatings happen because the husbands are illiterate and uneducated," she added. "But it also happens that the wife is not taking care of her husband or is not obedient. Then it is appropriate to beat the wife." Zoya smiled a bit when she saw the shock on our faces. She explained patiently, "I should not have been beaten, because I was always obedient and did what my husband said. But if the wife is truly disobedient, then of course the husband has to beat her." In short, women themselves absorb and transmit misogynistic values, just as men do. This is not a tidy world of tyrannical men and victimized women, but a messier realm of oppressive social customs adhered to by men and women alike. As we said, laws can help. But the greatest challenge is to change these ways of thinking. And perhaps the very best means of combating suffocating traditions is education. Through schools like one of our favorites, in a remote nook of the Pakistani Punjab, run by one of the world's most extraordinary women. Mukhtar's School. The most effective change agents aren't foreigners, but local women, and sometimes men, who galvanize a movement. Women like Mukhtar Mai. Mukhtar grew up in a peasant family in the village of Mirwala in southern Punjab. When people ask her age, she tosses out one number or another, but the truth is that she doesn't have a clue as to when she was born. Mukhtar never attended school, because there was no school for girls in Mirwala, and she spent her days helping out around the house. Then, in July 2002, her younger brother, Shakur, was kidnapped and gang-raped by members of a higher-status clan, the Masto. In Pakistan, rapes of boys by heterosexual men are not uncommon and are less stigmatized than the rapes of girls. Shakur was 12 or 13 at the time, and after raping him, the Masto became nervous that they might be punished. So they refused to release Shakur and covered up their crime by accusing him of having had sex with a Masto girl, Salma. Because the Masto had accused Shakur of illicit sex, the village tribal assembly, dominated by the Masto, held a meeting. Mukhtar attended on behalf of her family to apologize and to try to soothe feelings. A crowd gathered around Mukhtar, including several Masto men armed with guns, and the tribal council concluded that an apology from Mukhtar would not be enough. To punish Shakur and his family, the council sentenced Mukhtar to be gang-raped. Four men dragged her, screaming and pleading, into an empty stable next to the meeting area, and as the crowd waited outside, they stripped her and raped her on the dirt floor, one after the other. They know that a woman humiliated in that way has no other recourse except suicide, Mukhtar wrote later. They don't even need to use their weapons. Rape kills her. After administering the sentence, the rapists pushed Mukhtar out of the stable and forced her to stagger home, almost naked, before a jeering crowd. Once home, she prepared to do what any Pakistani peasant woman would normally do in that situation: kill herself. Suicide is the expected way for a woman to cleanse herself and her family of the shame. But Mukhtar's mother and father kept watch over her and prevented that option. Then, a local Muslim leader, one of the heroes in this story, spoke up for her at Friday prayers and denounced the rape as an outrage against Islam. As the days passed, Mukhtar's attitude mutated from humiliation to rage. Finally, she did something revolutionary. She went to the police and reported the rape, demanding prosecution. The police, somewhat surprisingly, then arrested the attackers. President Pervez Musharraf heard about the case and sympathized, sending Mukhtar the equivalent of $8,300 in compensation. But instead of taking the money for herself, Mukhtar decided to invest it in what her village needed most: schools. "Why should I have spent the money on myself?" she told Nick on his first visit to Merwala. "This way, the money is helping all the girls, all the children." During that first visit, Mukhtar was hard to get to know. When her father greeted Nick and invited him into the house, it took Nick a while to figure out who Mukhtar was. Mukhtar's father and brothers did all the talking, and Mukhtar was simply one of several women who listened in the back. She covered her face with a scarf, and all he could see were her eyes, burning with intensity. Time after time, when Nick would ask Mukhtar a question, her older brother would answer. "So, Mukhtar, why did you use your money to start a school?" "She started a school because she believes in education." After a couple of hours, the novelty of having an American in the house wore off, and the men became fidgety and wandered off to do errands. Finally, Mukhtar herself began to speak, her voice muffled by the scarf. She spoke passionately of her belief in the redemptive quality of education, in her hope that men and women in the villages could live together in harmony if only they had an education. The best way to overcome the attitudes that led to her rape, she said, was to spread education. The police were stationed in Mukhtar's home, nominally to protect her, and they listened to the entire interview. Afterward, Mukhtar steered Nick aside to plead for help. "The police are just stealing from my family," she said angrily. "They're not helping us. And the government has forgotten about me. It made promises to help my school, but it does nothing." The new Mukhtar My School for Girls stood next to her house, and Mukhtar had enrolled in her own school, sitting beside the littlest girls and learning to read and write with them. But the school was unfinished and running out of operating funds. Nick's columns about Mukhtar, who at the time went by a variant of her name, Mukhtaran Bibi, brought her $350,000 in contributions from readers, but also harassment from the government. President Musharraf was a modern man who initially admired Mukhtar's courage and was ready to help her, but he wanted Pakistan to be renowned for a sizzling economy, not notorious for barbaric rapes. Mukhtar's public comments, including her insistence that rape of poor women was a systemic problem, embarrassed him. So the intelligence services began to lean on Mukhtar to keep quiet. She refused to do so, and the government fired a warning shot. Officials ordered the release of the men who had been convicted of raping her. Mukhtar collapsed in tears. "I'm afraid for my life," she told us by phone that night. Still, she wouldn't back down, and her response was to call on the Pakistani government to pay more attention to women's rights. Mukhtar went ahead with plans to visit the United States and speak at a conference on women. So President Musharraf, by his own account, put her on the exit control list, a blacklist of Pakistanis barred from leaving the country. Mukhtar denounced the Pakistani government for doing so and refused to be intimidated. So then the intelligence services put her under house arrest and cut off her telephone landline. But she could still go up on her roof and get a weak cell phone connection, so she used it to describe to us how the police, who were supposedly protecting her, were now pointing their guns at her. Enraged at Mukhtar's continued defiance and outspokenness, Musharraf ordered her kidnapped, or as he euphemistically put it, brought to the capital. Intelligence agents bustled Mukhtar into a car, and a convoy drove her to Islamabad, where she was furiously berated. "You have betrayed your country and helped our enemies," an official told her. "You have shamed Pakistan before the world." Then the intelligence officers led Mukhtar, sobbing bitterly, off to a safe house, where she was prevented from contacting anyone. As all this was transpiring, Pakistan's foreign minister was visiting the White House and hearing President George W. Bush publicly praise Musharraf's bold leadership. Publicity about Pakistan's harassment of Mukhtar was embarrassing to the Bush administration, so Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called the Pakistani foreign minister and told him it had to stop. The authorities released Mukhtar. Musharraf's aides proposed that when the tempest died down, Pakistani officials accompany Mukhtar on a tightly chaperoned visit to the United States, where she would emphasize what a fine job the Pakistani government was doing. Mukhtar refused. "I only want to go of my own free will," she said. Mukhtar also complained publicly that her passport had been seized. Soon, Musharraf returned the passport and allowed her to visit the United States on her own. By now, Musharraf had turned Mukhtar into a celebrity. She was invited to the White House and the State Department, and the French foreign minister discussed international affairs with her. Glamour magazine flew Mukhtar first class to New York to honor her as a woman of the year at a banquet where she was introduced by someone she had never heard of, Brooke Shields. Laura Bush offered a video tribute, noting, "Please don't assume that it's only a tale of heartbreak. Mukhtaran proves that one woman really can change the world." On that visit, Mukhtar sat in her palatial hotel suite on Central Park West, dizzied by the attention and luxury, and deeply homesick for Mirwala. She worried about what would happen to the girls in her school during her absence. She found the interviews tiresome, partly because reporters weren't interested in her school, but only in the rape. That's all they asked. So what was it like being gang-raped? Mukhtar had a disastrous live interview on the CBS Morning News in which she was asked about it. Mukhtar indignantly replied, "I don't really want to talk about that." There was an awkward silence. During her American visit, Mukhtar was repeatedly invited by important people to dine in fancy restaurants. She kept asking for Pakistani takeout. Officials would tell Mukhtar how active their governments or aid groups were in Pakistan, and she would ask, "Where in Pakistan do you operate?" And the answer would come, "Islamabad, Karachi, Lahore." Mukhtar would shake her head and say, "Where we need help is the countryside. Please go to the villages and do your work there." Mukhtar herself lived by that credo. Sympathetic aid workers constantly urged her to move to Islamabad, where she could be safe, but she refused to discuss it. "My work is in my village," she said when we brought it up. "That is where the needs are. I'm afraid, but I will meet my fate. It is in God's hands." Visitors to events where Mukhtar was honored saw a shy woman with a headscarf getting one standing ovation after another. When she appeared in Glamour, she set the magazine's all-time record for clothing-to-skin ratio. But Mukhtar's passion was always her school and her village, and most of her work was not at all glamorous. Nick has twice been a commencement speaker at Mukhtar's school, and the ceremony is quite a sight. More than 1,000 students, parents, and relatives gather in a huge tent erected in a field, and they watch the students sing and perform skits warning against wife-beating or early marriage. The mood is festive, and even some of the children of Mukhtar's imprisoned rapists take part. The girls incongruously break into spasms of laughter when pretending to be beaten by their husbands. Yet the constant message is for parents to keep girls in school, and that is an obsession for Mukhtar. She was particularly determined to save one of her fourth grade students, Halima Amir, from being pulled out of school to be married. Halima was 12, tall and thin with long black hair, and she had been engaged at age 7 to a boy 5 years older. "I saw him once," Halima said of her fiancé, As-Salem. "I never talked to him. I wouldn't recognize him if I saw him again. I don't want to get married now." Halima had been first in her class the previous year, and her favorite subject was English. Her fiancé was illiterate. But her parents worried that she would soon hit puberty, and they wanted her to be married off before she might develop a crush on someone else and start people gossiping, or damage her most valuable possession of all, her hymen. Time and again, Mukhtar went to Halima's home, pleading with her parents to keep her in school. The drama was unfolding during one of Nick's visits to the school, and so on his next trip, he asked about Halima. "She's not here anymore," another student explained. "Her parents arranged a marriage for her. They waited until Mukhtar was away on a trip, and then they pulled Halima out of school and married her off. Now she's living a long way away." Not every battle ends in victory. With the help of the contributions people sent her, Mukhtar expanded her activities. She built a girls' high school and began operating a school for boys as well. She obtained a herd of dairy cows to provide income to sustain the schools. She bought a school van that doubles as an ambulance to take pregnant women to a hospital when they are ready to deliver. She built another school in a nearby gangster-ridden area where even the government didn't dare operate, and the gangsters, rather than rob the school, enrolled their own children in it. She persuaded the province to build a women's college to absorb her high school's graduates. Mukhtar welcomes volunteers to teach English in her schools and will give them free room and board as long as they commit to staying a few months. We can't imagine a richer learning experience. Mukhtar also started her own aid group, the Mukhtar Mai Women's Welfare Organization, which operates a 24-hour hotline for battered women, a free legal clinic, a public library, and a shelter for victims of violence. That was necessary because as Mukhtar's fame spread, partly through a weekly television show she launched, women from around the country started showing up at her home. They arrived by bus, foot, taxi, or rickshaw, and often they didn't even have money to pay the driver. The rickshaw drivers came to realize that if they showed up at Mukhtar's home with a sobbing woman, Mukhtar would pay the fare. Then Mukhtar used her prominence to nudge police, journalists, and lawyers to help the victims. Mukhtar didn't speak with sophistication or learning, but she was relentless and effective, and when women came to her with their faces destroyed by acid attacks or with their noses chopped off, a traditional punishment for bad or loose women, Mukhtar arranged plastic surgery. Mukhtar herself changed with time. She learned Urdu and became fluent. When we first visited Mirwala, she asked permission from her father or older brother every time she left the house. That became less tenable when she was hosting ambassadors, so she began going out without permission. This offended her older brother. Her father and younger brother admire her too much to be bothered, and put a strain on the family. At one point, her older brother threatened to kill her unless she was more obedient. It didn't help that the forlorn women who were arriving at Mukhtar's doorstep were devouring the family's food and monopolizing the outhouse. But her older brother mellowed, for he is also moved by the stories of the visitors. A bit grudgingly, he admits that his sister is doing extraordinary work, and that times are changing. Mukhtar always used to cover her face and hair entirely, with just her eyes peeking through a slit. At the banquets where she was being honored in the United States, men had been warned not to try to shake hands with her, to hug her, or, most scandalous, to peck her on the cheek. Yet after a year or so, Mukhtar became less finicky about her headscarf and began to shake hands with men. Her faith is still enormously important to her, but she realizes that the world will not end if her scarf drops. As Mukhtar's fame grew, the government began to push back. President Musharraf was still aggrieved at her for embarrassing Pakistan, so his intelligence services harried her and her supporters. An arrest warrant was issued against one of Mukhtar's brothers on manifestly bogus charges. For a time, the Pakistani government denied us visas because we had championed her case and were close to her. The intelligence apparatus planted articles in Urdu-language newspapers accusing Mukhtar of extravagance, totally untrue, or of being a stooge for Indians, and for Nick in their supposed efforts to harm Pakistan. Some upper-class Pakistanis, while originally sympathetic to Mukhtar, scorned her as an uneducated peasant and were uncomfortable with the way she was lionized abroad. They unskeptically accepted the slander that she was a money-hungry publicity hound, and they urged us to focus not on Mukhtar, but on the work of doctors and lawyers in the cities. "Mukhtar means well, but she's just a peasant," one Pakistani told us scornfully. All the slanders left Mukhtar deeply wounded. "My life and death is in God's hands," she said, as she had before. "That doesn't bother me. But why does the government keep treating me as if I were a liar and a criminal? For the first time, I feel that the government has a plan to deal with me," Mukhtar added. The plan, she said, was to kill or imprison her, or to fake a scandal to discredit her. Sure enough, a senior police official warned that if she was uncooperative, the government would imprison her for fornication. Fornication. On any given night, there were about a dozen or other women taking shelter alongside Mukhtar on the floor of her bedroom. She gave the bed itself to Nasim Akhtar, her chief of staff. President Musharraf even sent a warning through a top aide to Amna Buttar, a courageous Pakistani-American physician who was planning to accompany Mukhtar on a visit to New York. Mukhtar should watch her tongue in America, because the Pakistani government could hire local thugs to kill her and make it look like a mugging. Buttar passed the warning on to us. Nasim told us, "I want you to know that no matter how we are killed, even if it looks like an accident, it isn't. So if we die in a train accident or a bus accident or a fire, then tell the world that it was not actually an accident." Mukhtar's courage is having an impact, and she has shown that great social entrepreneurs don't come just from the ranks of the privileged. Rapes used to be widespread in rural Pakistan because there was no disincentive, but Mukhtar changed the paradigm, and women and girls began to fight back and go to the police. In 2007, a case similar to Mukhtar's unfolded in a village called Habib Labano. A young man eloped with his high-caste girlfriend, outraging the girl's family, so a high-caste council resolved to take revenge on a 16-year-old girl, Saima, who was a cousin of the young man. 11 men kidnapped the girl and paraded her naked through the village, and then, on council orders, 2 men raped her. Inspired by Mukhtar, Saima didn't kill herself. Instead, her family sought prosecution. Saima went for a medical checkup that confirmed the rape, and aid groups moved to help her. After a protest that blocked a road, the higher authorities fired 2 police officers and arrested 5 of the lower-ranking suspects. It wasn't exactly justice, but it was progress. Raping poor girls is no longer always a penalty-free sport, and so rapes appear to have declined considerably in the southern Punjab. There is no data, but inhabitants in village after village say that rapes used to be common and are now rare. Mukhtar has also galvanized other change makers, creating echoes of herself. Farooq Leghari is a bull of a man, a tough cop who speaks English and has been seasoned by service in some of the toughest parts of Pakistan. In a long conversation at a police post that he commands, he spoke of ruling by fear, of beating up suspects to make them confess.